Okay. So, in the early part of the 20th century, there was an interview with John D. Rockefeller. Now, you may have heard of him. He was the founder of Standard Oil. He was the first U.S. billionaire. He was a philanthropist, and he was also a social Darwinist, which meant that he felt that those who rise to the top financially or socially do so because they are somehow better than the rest of us. Anyway, in this interview, he was asked, "Mr. Rockefeller, how much money is enough?" And I picture him pausing a moment and then saying, "Just a little bit more. Just a little bit more." Now, he may have been joking a bit, right? But we have our own billionaires today, and some of them are also philanthropists, but some of them, it seems, feel that their craving for just a little bit more justifies literally taking food out of the mouths of hungry children. And those of us who are not billionaires, which includes me, look at this and we say, what are they thinking? This is obscene. Why don't they think they have enough, you know? And of course, I can't read their minds, but what I picture this deep hole of need, this feeling of lack in their psyche somehow. And this is a hole that cannot be filled. It can never be filled. And to me, that is the definition of suffering. That cannot be a happy way to look at the world. So now we know from studying the first two noble truths that the way out of that is not to keep trying to fill the hole. The way out is to let go of the craving. So how do we do that? Of course, we've all had our own cravings, right? Our own arguments with what is right now. And in the book, What the Buddha Taught, by Walpola Ruhala, who is a scholar and a monk, he said, dukkha arises because of thirst, craving, and it ceases because of wisdom. And in Dancing with Life, Philip Moffat says, knowing that you know the first noble truth, knowing that you know, that's what's important. Because there's a difference between intellectually knowing something and knowing something experientially, right? So being able to not just understand theoretically what we're talking about here, but to be able to see it in ourselves through our practice, beginning to see when craving arises and what happens and how we feel. And then through our practice, eventually, to be able to let go of it. So I've been thinking about a couple of things that I have learned this month in particular about the third noble truth that have really kind of struck me. And one is about this thing that we call nibbana, right? This state of consciousness that we call nibbana. And I had always pictured this as this really exalted state of consciousness. And once you get there and you're enlightened and that's it. And that just seemed like this overwhelming goal to me. But I've discovered that it's not really exactly like that. And that it's something that can come in small doses. I mean, maybe for some people it is, but for me at least, and I think for most of us, it comes in small doses when we are actually able to be present with what is. And I think the definition of the word, the etymology of the word nibbana is what really struck me, because it demystifies it for me a bit. And what it means is cooling. The cooling, it refers to the cooling of the rice before you eat it. And what we're talking about is the cooling of the craving, the cooling of these difficult emotions that craving produces, so that we can be fully present and we are not arguing with the present moment. And the other thing that I have been thinking a lot about is the connection of craving to this sense of a separate self. And we are fully conditioned to believe that we have a separate self, right? I mean, this is me. I'm in here. I'm in this body. I'm in this mind. And the vast importance of what I want and what I need and everything. And in a way, we're addicted to it, right? I mean, when everything is going well and people are praising us and loving us, oh, that feels so good. But then there are the other times when we're not succeeding and people aren't so enthralled with us and things, and that just doesn't feel so good. And I think I've come to the conclusion that on some deep level of our being, we know that this concept of a separate self is trouble. I mean, we say things like, that movie was so great, I lost myself in that movie. I lost myself in that book. And what are we doing then? We're basically distracting ourselves for a short period of time from our story with somebody else's story. But it's like we want to get away from our story sometimes. It's oppressive, right? And what about, you know, what about addictions to drugs or alcohol or sugar or whatever? Isn't this just a way of numbing that sense of self? So I think that there is some understanding deep within us that thinning that attachment to the concept of a separate self is something that is very beneficial. You know, it's freeing. It's freeing. And of course, the understanding and the ability to do that come with practice through time. So I have been thinking about times when I was fully present and how I got there. And these are the things I want to share with you. First of all, there are times when I think we just fall into mindfulness. Now, I know athletes talk about being in the zone, the times when they are just so much at one with the movements of their sport that they are just completely connected to it, and that's it. They're not thinking about themselves, their little self, right? And I know as a musician and as a writer, I know that artists also experience that. Like when I'm playing the piano, for example, and I've been playing piano since I was 8 years old. And there are times if I'm playing well, believe me, I'm not always present when I'm playing the piano. When I'm playing well, sometimes I'm thinking, oh, wow, I am so good. And anybody who's hearing me just must be so impressed. And then there are the opposite times when I'm feeling a little shaky and I'm thinking, oh, I'm not doing very well. I'm going to make a mistake. What if somebody hears me make a mistake? Oh, my God. But then there are also the times when there is nothing but the music, when my fingers are just an extension of the music. And that is like pure bliss. And that's probably why I still play the piano after all these years. And then there is my experience with the firewood that I wrote about in that poem. Now, I was in that time, I was living in the countryside of Quebec, as I said. I was living on the property of some dear friends. They were and still are like family. And I call them my brother and my sister. And I helped raise their children. And, of course, we were using firewood, burning firewood for heat. And we had taken stock of our pile of firewood, and we realized we did not have enough to get through the cold Quebec spring. Now, a few weeks earlier, I had cut up a big maple tree into rounds and with a chainsaw, and we just piled it on the ground. We didn't get it split, and we didn't get it stacked. And then the weather had changed. It had turned really, really cold, and tons of snow had come, and that firewood was just buried. But we realized if we could dig it out and chop it up and stack it, that it would start to dry out, and it would be there for the spring. So that's what we did. And for some reason, and this was not always the case, believe me, when we were working, but for some reason, we were fully present that day with the work. Maybe we had a really good meditation that morning. I don't remember. And it was not ideal conditions by any means. It was freezing cold outside. That wood was buried, and it was frozen solid. But we were there. We were just there with it. And it's like we needed more firewood. We didn't have enough firewood, but the experience of getting that firewood did not need to be any more than it was. The process was enough because we were present with the whole process of it. Now, of course, it's great when that happens, but it doesn't happen all that often. I have noticed more often than not, it's a choice to be present. For example, a few weeks ago, I had a plumbing problem here in my apartment, and the maintenance guy from the apartment came over to fix it. He came in the late afternoon, and he was still working on it by 8 o'clock in the evening, and when he left, he had made the situation worse. So I had a bathroom sink that did not drain at all, but it filled up with mucky water whenever I ran the water in the kitchen sink. And he said, well, we're just going to have to get a plumber tomorrow. So I knew I was going to be all night and much of the next day with this situation. And I saw my choice. The situation was what it was. I could either just go with it and be present with it, or I could get really frustrated and I could blame the maintenance guy and on, you know the story. And I decided, it was obvious what was going to be more pleasant for me. I said, I will be present with this. I will just go with it. And I did. And certainly my practice helped me stay there. And the next day the plumber came and the situation got fixed. And so, yes, the plumbing needed to be fixed. But the experience of getting the plumbing fixed did not have to be fixed, because I was present with it. And then there are the times when I decide to be present and it doesn't work immediately. So, a few weeks ago also, I had a situation with my tax forms. Now, last year, I was working for a company in Montreal, and I continued working for them until last year. But I still had several months of salary from last year, so I had to get my tax forms from them. And when I first started working for this company, it was this wonderful little company, very cohesive, great communication, you know. But then it had been sold to this big company from the UK, and they started changing things, and they were really hard to communicate with. You could email them, and they just wouldn't answer. They didn't feel like answering. They didn't answer. So I thought, okay, I got to get my tax forms from these people. And the only reason I knew they were ready is because a friend of mine who still worked there texted me and told me they were ready. They didn't tell me. The company didn't tell me. So I was a little bit dreading it. But I said, okay, no, I'm going to be present with this. I am going to be present with this. And I started in. I emailed the HR person. No response. I emailed her again. Finally, she answered, oh, yeah, they're ready. Okay, I'll get them. I'll email them to you. They didn't come. This went on for a week and a half. And in spite of practicing every day and saying, every day I'm going to be present, I was getting more and more frustrated. And I was blaming her. And, you know, the whole situation was very unpleasant. I did not want to be where I was in the process of getting those tax forms. I wanted to be down the road where I already had them. Finally, we get to this week where she said, okay, I'm going to have them to you by Friday, for sure. Friday comes, Friday goes, no tax forms. I was beside myself. Saturday, was very bad. But then Sunday came. And so Sunday morning, I tuned in to this meditation, and Lyndall was leading, and she gave us this lovely introduction to the Third Noble Truth. And then we had breakout groups, and I got to talk about my tax forms and how frustrated I was. And by the end, I felt things beginning to loosen a little bit, just a little bit. And then that evening, I went to lead the Dances of Universal Peace. Now, this is something I have been doing for years. These are meditative dances that use the sacred phrases and the mantras from all the world's spiritual traditions. And I was leading with two other leaders. And one of the dances I was leading was based on the Brahma Viharas, you know, metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and upekkha, equanimity. So I had to teach the people the words, the music, the movements, and what all of these words meant. And it was lovely. The dance went really well. It was very, very meditative dance. And then there were the other dances from different traditions. The whole evening was very joyful, very meditative, and very inspiring. And when I got home, I realized that it was gone. My frustration was gone. I felt so free. It was, wow. And I realized I was no longer blaming the HR person. I was no longer angry. I even sent her some metta, right? But of course, I still had to get those tax forms. So I said, okay, tomorrow I'm going to send another email. And this time I'm going to include the head of development, this guy I'd known for many years, because I feel like I want a witness. And what I'm going to write, I have no idea. So the next day I sit down to my computer, I start my email. The first thing I say is, I am not blaming you. I know you are doing your best. And it was the truth. And I realized that the way I had been emailing her before, I had been really trying to butter her up so that she would like me and do what I wanted, which hadn't worked at all. But what followed in this email really surprised me. It was very stern and very exacting. And I said, this company has a legal responsibility to get those tax forms to me, and I need them now. And what I realized is that, yes, it was not rainbows and, you know, kittens or anything. I mean, it was very, very stern, but it was honest. It was the truth. And my mind that was suddenly free of this craving for things to be different was much more honest than it had been before. And, you know, I read the email through, let it sit for a few minutes, and then I sent it. And I closed my computer and I went and I did other things and I didn't even think about it. And a couple of hours later, I came back, turned on the computer for something else. I don't even remember what. And I saw I had an email and I looked and there were my tax forms. So my liberated mind was not only much happier, it was also more effective. I did what I needed to do. So then I'm thinking, okay, well, why did this work? Why could I let go with the plumbing, but I couldn't immediately with the tax forms? And I realized that it was the factor of uncertainty. With the plumbing, there was a plan. The tax forms, it was like, I didn't know what was going on. By that Saturday, I was even thinking, they didn't even do my tax forms. You know, I was making stuff up. And but then I realized, but uncertainty is always a factor. It's like the Buddha says, the future is always other than you imagined it. And uncertainty is always there. But for some reason, I felt it more with the tax forms. And so it's all, but I also realized it's not a case of, you know, being present is not a case of not making changes. You make changes when you need to. I needed more firewood. I needed the plumbing fixed. I needed the tax forms. These were all things I had to act on. But these are processes. And what it is being able to be present in the process of where you're at. And I was able to do that with the firewood. I was able to do that with the plumbing, but it took a while to do it with the tax forms. But I had set the intention at the beginning, and I had continued to practice. And finally, because of the two events of Sunday, this sit and the leading the dances, it brought my intention and my focus into realization. And I wasn't even thinking about it, of course, when I was doing these things, but it let go. It just let go. Okay, so these are, you know, the things I've been talking about are basically the ups and downs of daily life. I'm not talking about the big stuff, climate change, war, poverty, you know, all of that, or the big personal losses, you know, death of a loved one, ending of a relationship, losing your job, all these things. But I think that we can begin with the smaller things, the things we have a little bit more feeling of control over, these big things. I mean, we literally have no control over many of them. And like a few weeks ago, Anam Thubten was here and he said, with some of these things that we can't control, all we can do is get to a place of non-judgmental awareness, hold them in this non-judgmental awareness. And again, it's a process, and sometimes it's a long process. But if we start with the little stuff, I think we build our mindfulness muscle, right? Okay, so I have been talking enough here, and you have been listening enough. So as I said, I do want to stay in the big group today for the question and answer period. And before we do that, I would like to do the announcements, because I don't like to do them at the end because I get rushed. And we have some really neat things coming up here. On April 4th, Tuari Salah, one of our guiding teachers, will be giving a talk from 7 to 9. That's hybrid. No registration is needed for that. And then the next 2 days, April 5th and 6th, from 9 to 4:30, she will be doing a retreat, which is also hybrid. You do have to register for that. and we will not be having the Sunday sit that weekend. Then Tuareg is also doing a retreat on Samish Island with the Bellingham Insight Meditation Group on April 19th. It starts April 19th. It's a week-long retreat. The link to the Bellingham site is on our website, or you can just Google it. I do happen to know that that retreat is full at this point, but they are adding people to a waiting list, but they have to have their registration by April 4th to even get on the waiting list, okay? And then May 2nd, the Venerable Panavati is doing a talk, hybrid again, from 7 to 9, no registration needed. And then May 3rd and 4th, she's doing a retreat, also hybrid, 9 to 4:30. Registration is required for that, and again, no Sunday sit that weekend. And I just want to say a brief word about Dana, which means generosity. Seattle Insight is an all-volunteer organization. We offer the teachings freely to everyone who comes, but we also at the same time do depend on your generosity. There are two ways to offer Dana. One is financial, and the other is by volunteering. And on every single page of our website, up in the right-hand corner, there is a donate button and a volunteer button. So, okay. So now, the floor is open. I would really like to hear about your experiences with any of the three noble truths that we have so far addressed. Since we do have two screens, it would be good if you could raise your virtual hand up down at the bottom. It says raise hand, I think. I mean, on mine, it does.
It says react.
Okay, yeah, some of them say reactions, right, and then you have to click on that and you can see the raise hand thing. So, and of course, any questions about your practice or about any of this are also welcome. All right, Suze.
Thank you so much for pointing us to the simpler moments of freedom. And I wanted to share an example, which is a little different than the ones you did.
Good.
And it's about letting go of the noise and all the details of a relationship situation where you've got all the things that aren't going right. And if this person were more like that, or if you were like that, or remember when that person said the wrong thing and all that. And, I was caught up in that, and I met with this friend, and we knew we were both going to have this kind of hard conversation. And what I said was, I'd really like to be closer to you. And the friend said, oh, I'd like that too. And there was just this moment of things falling away. I forgot all the list. I mean, they're still there. And of course, the devil's in the details, but there's something about going for the simple, for the kernel of it. And so it was another example similar to what you did, and where I wasn't even aware so much I was doing it, but when I went to the essence of the desire, which was just to be closer friends, and it was a moment of cooling. Felt really good.
Yeah, that's great. I had a similar experience. I think I told you about it actually, with a longtime friend, and we had had a really knockdown, drag out yelling match. We were garden partners, and it was over the garden. And so the next day I came, and she said, this time it was her, and I was just stewing and fretting, and I'm sure she was too. but we both had this desire to be friends. I mean, we're friends, you know, we've been friends forever, 50 years. And she said to me, okay, we got to talk this out. She said, you are a person I decided long ago to love. Mm-hmm. We have to fix this. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, we do. So, anyone else? Yes, Jason.
Yeah, mine's a little bit different, but on a similar ilk of a long-term relationship. So I myself am ending a very, very long-term relationship, and I'm learning to not argue with the present, as you kind of said, and just kind of live with what it is at this point. And, you know, still a day-to-day thing at this time, but it is, yeah, I don't know. It is comforting to kind of, you know, understand the framework and how this kind of fits along with where my path is at this point, I will say. So, yeah.
Great. Yeah. All been there, I think. And Tracy.
I wanted to ask a little bit about resistance.
Mm-hmm.
For me, like, I've been moving away from craving, but then I feel like I'm experiencing craving in reverse as resistance, if that makes any sense. Because there's still this, it's still not cooling. It's like it creates more heat, to use the rife analogy. And so I'm just wondering sort of where resistance fits into, where this fits into it. I mean, is it sort of the same thing as craving, but it's kind of,
yeah.
So I'm still trying to find the cooling, I suppose.
Yeah, it really is the same kind. It's aversion, essentially. And basically, it's a craving for things to be other than what they are, right? Where did you go? You lowered your hand and I lost. Oh, there you are. Okay. I like to look at the person I'm talking to. So, yeah, and I've certainly been there, too. And sometimes I have found sometimes it takes a long time. You know, I have worked with strong aversions, which took months to let go. And I remember something that Tuareg said. He said, you cannot force the mind to let go. You do the practice. Eventually, it will just get worn out and it will give up and it will let go. And that was my experience, but it took a long time. I mean, some things go deep, you know. Some aversions go very deep. Aversions and attachments go very deep. But you just keep working. The practice will do you eventually. You know, it's like with my tax forms. I wanted to let go immediately. I didn't want to go through all that, you know. But I had no choice. It just took a while. But you set the intention. You keep the practice going. Eventually it will let go. But it is the same thing, yeah. And Lauren.
Yeah, I could respond to many, many of your examples. And I recently had an issue with my debit cards, and it started on a Friday night, and I couldn't. I wanted to use it, you know, that weekend, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't get a response until Monday, of course. And boy, did I just fume and blame. And it's those bureaucratic kind of on the phone communication ones that really I am subject to. And I do want to say that that weekend, I did have a Sunday sit, and I saw the reprieve I had during the Sunday sit, but it wasn't quite enough. It wasn't as total as yours, maybe because I didn't have the dance going on in the evening. So I really enjoyed you giving us these very concrete examples. The last one where you explained the sternness, mm-hmm. the letting go of blame, but the sternness at the same time, reminded me of the model the Buddha gave with Angulimala, which has always really helped me, because Angulimala was a murderer and was intent on murdering the Buddha. And he had there was no issue of blame or you're a bad person. It was just, no, you stop. You know, that's it. There was just, you need to stop the action. And I felt that was really helpful when I see I'm trying to make somebody else a bad person or a system a bad person, bad, and blame. And that it's actually just that I have to be clear about what needs to happen. And it doesn't have all that baggage with it. It's not entangled. It's just stop. So anyway, I really liked your wisdom that you did have to ask for what you wanted and be firm, but you didn't have to blame. And that's what, how you got what you, that's how it unraveled. So I just wanted to say that. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. It surprised me, you know.
Yeah.
It surprised me. And I was thinking about, I really should write a book on the dukkha of bureaucracy.
Yeah.
I think it gets it all, us all. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren. Nina.
Oh, thank you so much for this lovely talk. And, you know, your talk reminded me about, which I had never thought about before, about the times that I did release, even before I started practice, the many times that I was present and was able to give up my frustrations and just be with what was, you know. And in the last months, the teachings on the Four Noble Truths have also showed me that those times are, as you had explained, it's like the little nirvanas, the little times of, you know, peacefulness that come, or ease of life. And that's been a real revelation to me, and a great teaching about what the Buddha has said, that there is a cessation of suffering, even a little at a time. So I thank you about that. Thanks.
Thank you, Nina. Yeah, it's very interesting to realize on an experiential level that, you know, that Buddha, he knew what he was talking about. He really did. Yeah. Gene.
Thank you for this talk this morning, Judith. It was exactly what I needed to hear. I came with a chip on my shoulder, and because of the political atmosphere, and I was not seeing any hope. I thought, okay, Buddha, come on, you gave us these first two noble truths, and then there's this magical end of suffering. But what is the hope? Where does it exist? Where does it come from? And and I realized in your storytelling that I could see the hope. I will let the Dhamma do its thing with me, and I will find release from this. And that was a really positive and beautiful thing for me to hear. And it already feels like a whole lot of the sting has gone out of it for me. In particular, I have a friend, a Canadian friend, who used to post a lot of things, his reaction to our current political leader, and now he is afraid to come across the border to join me in retreat at Samish Island because he thinks he could be held for his actions, and he is one of the most beautiful people I know. In order to make this retreat work, he's probably put in 1,000 hours since June, and does not deserve that action, but and there isn't much I can do about that. That's dukkha. But my own reaction to the situation is very controllable. Mm-hmm. And I am seeing hope there. So thank you for your talk this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jean. I've certainly had a lot of those same feelings, being both Canadian and American. That was one that, I've had to work with a lot. And, you know, it's true. There is unavoidable dukkha. I mean, there is unavoidable suffering. We hurt ourselves, and it hurts. It hurts. But then, what do we add to it? Do we add a lot of fear, a lot of anger, a lot of impatience? Or do we just let it be what it is? Because it's not a value judgment, you know? Things are as they are. And if we are arguing with the way they are at any given moment, it causes suffering. It's just the way it works, right?
And all my suffering cannot change what is.
No. And the thing is, the situation also will change. It will change. Everything changes. Everything changes. Nothing is permanent. And we don't know how it's going to change. But we do know. And one thing that helped me is to realize it's the process. It's the process. Mm-hmm. It's not that I have to say, oh, yeah, this is okay, the way this is happening, right, or anything else, but we are where we are in the process. If I'm going to fight with where I am right now, I'm just going to cause myself more suffering. That's all. I'm not going to make it be different.
True.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lillian or Nikhil, whichever one wants to speak.
I wanted to respond to what you said about the John D. Rockefeller quote, and then also what you and you, Judith, and you, Tracy, were talking about with time. I think I connected so strongly to that quote, and it seems to me that in any given moment, the craving arises for me in that exact way. Like, what would be the right amount of pancakes? What would be the right amount of time to do what I want to do? Just a little bit more than what I have, but I think what you pointed to and what really resonated for me was how the passage of time really changes that. And I think with craving and aversion both, it's really remarkable sometimes looking back at that time I was craving that stack of pancakes, how much I've like loosened myself from that, or how much that craving is just not present anymore in the current moment. And I think that opening up through time is really just interesting, but I think it also just shows like it's like that liberation in a sense of time. We can have those like small moments of liberation where we are able to sort of be with something or be with the path, but then we can also have the greater liberation over time of just showing that like that thing is impermanent, like you were saying, and that thing, that craving, has disappeared in a way. So I really appreciate that from you, Nicole.
Great, thank you. I think it really helps me to look back and see where I used to be, right? Yeah. how much more caught in my reactions I was. And now if I do get caught in them, obviously the tax forms is a good experience, but at least I can see it and I know what's happening. And then eventually it's worth it to set the intention, you know, because even if it doesn't happen immediately, the intention is there. The understanding is there, you know, and as they say, it starts with understanding. It starts with knowing, knowing that you know. We know now. We have no excuse. Okay, Nana.
Thank you very much, Judith. And I'm specifically thanking you for the specific applied wisdom in the examples you shared. And if I recall from one of the examples you shared, you talked about your friend saying, well, I'm committed to loving you, so I cannot unlove you. And what that activated, in my view, is this notion of, particularly related to the third noble truth of non-harm, doing no harm. And doing no harm here would apply to the first of the eightfold path. That in one's experience, there's a blamelessness that comes from and a courage that's required to embody actively choosing to do no harm. To whom? To oneself. Therefore, if I am unable to harm myself with the second arrow or with any other sensory contact, then it's impossible for me to harm you. Yet, it doesn't expose me to danger because this embodiment of compassion comes with it wisdom, an unpremeditated wisdom that enables one to be upaya, skillful, very skillful in the moment of difficulty. And a wisdom that's not dependent, to borrow from Eugene, that's not dependent on this non-being, but is activated by the embodiment of the true Dharma. And I think that's relevant at an individual level, at a Sangha level, and most importantly, at a collective level, knowing that it's only light that drives out darkness.
Right. Right. And our anger and our frustration is only adding more negativity. Right. So, yes, the commitment not to add to it. Not to add to it. Jordan.
Yeah, kind of want to touch on what you said about setting the intention. I've been in a situation for a long time now that I don't like and I don't want to be in the situation. And I've definitely tried to set an intention for, okay, how do I want to, obviously I don't want to be in this situation. So that's my intention. So I try to get it more specific. Okay, what does that new path look like? And I'm kind of just at a loss of what it would be. And so I continue to stay in this situation that I don't want to be in. And I'm just kind of stuck. Any thoughts or advice?
Well, of course, I can't comment upon your specific situation, but I think the way to begin is to simply sit with it. How does this feel? How does this situation feel? You know, rather than analyzing it so much, because analyzing, I mean, not that there's no room for analysis, obviously there is. But you can really get tangled up when you start analyzing things a lot. But I find that if I can just sit with, okay, how does this feel? How does dissatisfaction feel? Where am I feeling it in my body? You know, what's the experience of it?
And what's the experience of my frustration? And I find that doing that, things begin to lighten slowly, sometimes very slowly. And there is a process, and that helped me a lot to realize there is a process that we have to go through. And sometimes we don't like where we're at in that process, and then we are causing ourselves more suffering, like I was with the tax forms. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be at the end of it, right? But where you are right now is where you are. So that's what you have to, you don't have to, but that's the thing to come to terms with. That's the thing to feel. That's the thing to understand. I'm here. This is where I am right now. And sometimes if you can begin to see that and feel that and understand that, then the way forward starts to become more clear. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason you are where you are, right? Okay, Thomas.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Wanted to contribute another nuance around strong reactions and resistance and wanting and those kinds of things. And what I've noticed is that I'm very quick to make a judgment. So, for example, some years ago, I was laid off from a job that I was planning on continuing in for many years, like the organization. And so layoffs happened. And I was really, really frustrated that I couldn't continue as planned. And a few months later, I found myself in a new job in a new organization that I actually liked even better. And it was the first time I experienced layoffs. I was I had a lot of emotions about it. And I think it grew me stronger. It could happen again. And it's part of being in the labor market. And I'm just much more prepared. And I think also, yeah, it made me more confident about myself and my abilities. So my takeaway from that story is as these frustrations happen, when things don't go my way, I'm trying to hold that judgment, because sometimes I learn something, or it actually makes me do something I didn't think about, and I go different places I might not have gone by myself if that situation has happened. So holding that judgment and sort of being open to what's going on here, what are the possibilities, and why am I reacting strongly has been, it's just been great learning. And it's sometimes hard to do. Sometimes I forget it, but it really, yeah, it's just a really fruitful avenue. So just one more nuance to the discussion here.
Thank you. Yeah, so many times the thing that I did not want to happen happened and turned out to be the best thing in the world for me. Okay, I think we have time for one more. Christy.
I just wanted to thank Jordan for being vulnerable enough to say what I wanted to say, which is, now what the hell am I supposed to do? And I loved the response of, it is what it is. You're sitting there. What is the experience? And I realize, ooh, maybe I'm trying to hold on to my suffering, which is what's a very interesting thing. It's like, well, I don't want a resolution because the resolution may be very sad, but as Thomas said, who knows what's ahead. So, thank you for a wonderful talk and wonderful discussion.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for your contributions. I appreciate it so much. And let's just sit for just a few seconds and dedicate our practice today to the well-being and happiness of all beings. Okay? So thank you all. You are such beautiful people. It is such a privilege to be here with you.